It's time for the Reader's Almanac with Warren Bauer. Originally broadcast over station WNYC New York and distributed by National Educational Radio, the Reader's Almanac is America's oldest continuous book program. Here now is Mr. Bauer.
Now and again, a book comes up on the horizon of this program with special force and appeal. It carries excitement with it naturally because of the freshness of its subject matter. One wonders why the story has not been told before, so great is the natural interest in it. Now, such a book dropped on my desk not so long ago, a volume published by Random House called The Broken Seal by Ladislaus Farrago, a writer whose name I knew well, the author of Patton, Ordeal and Triumph, and a number of other volumes. The Broken Seal has a subtitle which will be useful to those who want to know first what a book is about. Well, this one is about the story of Operation Magic and the Pearl Harbor disaster. That is, what went on behind the scenes on the diplomatic front and what particularly went on as both sides sought to hide their necessary communications through the use of difficult codes and attempts to break the other's codes through what might be called cryptological espionage. Now, Operation Magic had a particular meaning and a very dramatic story told fully in this book, which brings the whole story right up to the morning of the Pearl Harbor disaster. Mr. Farrago is wholly at home in such a milieu. He has been involved with the field of intelligence during World War II in the Office of U.S. Naval Intelligence as Chief of Research and Planning. He has written several books in the field of intelligence, for example, Behind Closed Doors, written with Rear Admiral Ellis M. Zacharias. Another book is Burn After Reading, and in a different field, The Tenth Fleet and The Riddle of Arabia, just to demonstrate Mr. Farrago's versatility. Now, that term that I use, cryptological espionage, Mr. Farrago, sounds both fascinating and melodramatic. And having just finished reading The Broken Seal, I can assert that it is indeed that. But let's talk about the cryptological part of the phrase first. I suppose it means that you mean the devising and possibly the breaking of secret codes.
Yes, both the concealment of communications and what may be called the deconcealment, the decrypting of the methods used for concealment. And I came to the conclusion, I have no axe to grind, I'm interested in all forms of espionage, but I came to the conclusion that the cryptological espionage is the hinge in war and peace, that is to say in military affairs and in diplomacy, in the relation between nations. Namely, this is where you come to the core of what an adversary or an opponent, maybe a friend, maybe a foe, tries to conceal. And since he's eager to conceal it, it is the real McCoy.
Yes.
And if you succeed in getting to it and succeed in sort of recovering the code in which the concealment is done and reading his secrets, you penetrate to the very core of his intentions, plans, timetables, and so on. So therefore, as an example for it, for example, during the Second World War in the Battle of the Atlantic, as long as the Germans were reading our codes in which we did our convoy routings, they were the ones who were winning the Battle of the Atlantic. No sooner did we succeed in cracking the U-boat code of the Germans than we were winning the Battle of the Atlantic.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, I know, of course, that governments do not carry on communications in straight and undisguised language, naturally. But they do recognize that efforts are always being made to break codes. Now, this they take as a rule of the game. Now, what can they do to prevent the breaking of codes? Is there anything? Is just
no.
Changing it? That's
yes.
The only possibility?
Oh, they can do. You know, it is generally believed that there is a panacea in cryptology, namely the development of the so-called unbreakable cipher or the unbreakable code. Actually, the cryptologist is not so, who has no delusions. Some cryptologists have delusions, as a matter illusions. As a matter of fact, many have delusions even, because as Commander Rochefort once said it, you have to be a nut to be engaged in these activities. They have no illusions about the panacea. They know that there is no panacea. What they are trying to develop is the kind of code or the kind of cipher that will maintain a secret as long as it is necessary. Let's take for an example that there will be an invasion in Europe on the 6th of June 1944 in Normandy. And a code word had been devised for this operation, Overlord. Now, what the cryptologist is trying to do is to devise a code that will be secure enough for long enough to conceal the secret of this particular secret. Of course, if somebody cracks it on the 7th of June, it's very interesting from the point of view that the code had been cracked, but it's useless from the information and intelligence point of view, because the event which he tried to conceal had had taken place the day before.
Oh, yes.
So the basic aim of the cryptologist is to devise a code that will be safe as long as the secret have to be kept.
Mm-hmm. How close is it possible to get to the unbreakable code? I suppose that's an ideal that they recognize is off in the great beyond, but they must try to get close to it. What steps do they take to keep the code unbroken until it is no longer useful to them?
Well, generally, it was believed in the early 30s that a machine, that the automation of cryptology will make the codes unbreakable. Until then, most of the codes and ciphers used were so-called paper and pencil codes, which were devised and which you yourself wrote up on the base of code books or on the base of cryptosystems, prearranged cryptosystems. But then it was believed that maybe a machine will make the code unbreakable. So we in this country, and the English in that country, the Germans in that, the Germans, but especially the Japanese, went to extreme lengths in developing very complex, very complicated crypto machines. And the Japanese succeeded in developing one which really seemed unbreakable, and which they themselves were persuaded that it was unbreakable. But we attacked it ingeniously, that is to say, the United States cryptological establishment attacked this, quote, unbreakable, unquote, code, cipher machine, and in valiant and effort, in over a period of 19 months, they succeeded in reconstructing the machine itself. And from then on, without any blueprints, without ever having seen the machine, just by deducing the mechanical structure of the machine, from certain clues which developed out of intercepts and so on, out of the product of the machine. And then this proved that the machine is not unbreakable if you succeed in reconstructing the machine itself. As a matter of fact, once you have the machine, all you have to do is that to pick up any of the encoded messages, put through the machine, and you read it as clearly as it was when it was put into the machine.
Well, that's an extraordinary exercise of human ingenuity and intelligence, it seemed to me. There are, I suppose, principles, of course, upon which these men operate.
That's right. For example, a trained cryptologist looks at an encoded message or an enciphered message, and just intuitively or instinctively by looking at it on the base of experience and on the base of what is called a cipher brain, a sixth sense, he cracks 40% of it right off the bat. It, of course, the 60% represent tremendous hardships and difficulties, and sometimes the last 2%, the last 1% is the one which makes the code unbreakable to that particular man who is trying to take a crack at it. But the code itself, the cipher text itself, provides ipso facto certain clues from which the cryptologist, the trained cryptologist, proceeds and succeeds in breaking into the code, develops the principle. He can see right off the bat whether it's a transposition code, whether it's a substitution cipher, whether it's a code, whether it's a machine-based code or a paper and pencil code. And that's how it begins. Let's say you get 25% of it cracked right away and then start working from the clues, which is 25% yielded, on cracking the remaining 75%.
I'd like to pick up one little reference that you made there to the individual who is, well, not only well-trained in this, but has a feel for it. And perhaps you'd go even further than that, who might be, let's say, a genius at doing this kind of thing. He has a talent for it. He He looks at a code and he knows a great deal about it just in looking at it.
Right.
There aren't very many of these cryptanalysts around, are there? There can't be such skill as that.
It so happened that during the Second World War, when the United States, like any other country, any other belligerent power, went into cryptology on a tremendous scale, we had more than, maybe as many as 40, 50,000 people engaged in cryptology. But it doesn't mean that all those 40 and 50,000 have the cipher brain. As a matter of fact, very few of them do have. Most of the people are engaged in crypto-clerical tasks, like, for example, preparing frequency tables, trying to unravel a cipher by knowing that E is the most frequently used letter in the... So preparing these frequency tables.
That I can remember from Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes. And then, for example, others are engaged in, for example, in trying to apply already cracked systems to uncracked messages, that is to say, encoded messages. This way, for example, I used to know a young lady from Smith College. She was just out of Smith College, couldn't speak any language except English, and she was engaged in cracking Chinese ciphers, yes. But there is this elite in cryptology, and it's just a handful. I would say no more, in this country, I would say no more than maybe 30, 40 people who possess this cipher brain, and they are at the top who are really deal with penetration into systems, and they have a dual task. They not only crack the codes and ciphers of others, but also devise the codes and ciphers of the United States and try to make them as complex as possible. To talk about this unbreakable cipher, for example, during recent years to come up against an unbreakable cipher, which is proved unbreakable. You may recall a famous Soviet agent who operated in this country by the name of Colonel Abel.
Yes, I remember that.
A very remarkable, perhaps the most important agent who ever was assigned to the United States, certainly the most intelligent, the smartest. And he used the cipher, which proved unbreakable. Even before we succeeded in sort of apprehending him and finding him, we found one of his messages. By coincidence, a message was concealed in a nickel that had been hauled out for the purpose of transmitting messages. And by mistake, Abel must have spent this nickel. And it got into circulation. At one point, it was paid by a complete stranger, a third party who had absolutely no inkling of what kind of hot money he was harboring, was given in payment for a newspaper to a newsboy. The newsboy, who was then going down the steps, dropped this nickel. The nickel opened up and there was a message. And the message was then given to the FBI. The FBI recognized an espionage message encoded, severely encoded. They put the best FBI cryptologist on it. Then it was transmitted to the National Security Agency and they just never succeeded in cracking it. But then, these are the byways of espionage, the assistance of Colonel Abel defected to us. And he brought along the key to that code. And as soon as we had the key to the code, you see, most of the time, you don't have to go to the heartbreaking trouble of cracking a code. You go rather to the easier trouble of waiting for someone to defect from the enemy camp.
Yeah. Well, now I think we ought to know about that phrase, Operation Magic, and what that really means in this story of what led up to Pearl Harbor. For a long time, that code was certainly not cracked, wasn't it?
For 18 months.
Yes.
It was 19 months, as a matter
of fact.
That's
a long time.
As a matter of fact, it was much longer than that. It came into being 1937. The Japanese started using that particular cipher in 1937. And it was only in September 1940 that we succeeded in cracking it sufficiently to be able to read the messages in them. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese were extremely ingenious in developing that system. They departed from the conventional form of cipher machine. They were no longer using the conventional disks and wheels, but instead used relay switches, that is relays, electric relays, which was so novel a concept that it took 18 months even for these code crackers to think of it. Mm-hmm.
Now, the Japanese had confidence in that special code of theirs and so used it for super-secret purposes. There were, of course, a great many, and this is one of the things that I got out of your book that I certainly didn't know, that there are a great many codes for a great many different purposes.
Yes, well, every establishment within the government uses its own code. There are the diplomatic codes, there are the military codes, there are the naval codes, and they are, for example, the CIA uses a whole system of codes of its own today. The Japanese used the diplomatic code for certain types of messages, and then they had a more severe security system in cryptology for their naval organization, and then for the military, for the army, they used exclusively codes. I want to make this distinction between codes and ciphers. A code is a system which you devise, that is to say, where one thing means it's something entirely different, whereas a cipher is a system which is a form of manipulation of the alphabet or symbols. And a cipher is usually easier to crack because the way it is manipulated, this manipulation can be repeated or duplicated. Whereas a code, in order to penetrate to the meaning of a code, you usually have to acquire or procure the code book itself.
You make a very good point, interesting point, too, that the Japanese did not suspect that that Operation Magic had been cracked. Now, did we do something to keep it secret, that we had broken into it?
No, we did not. As a matter of fact, several times, twice in the history of our bout, cryptological bout with the Japanese, what you may call traitors, American employees of the establishment, went over to the Japanese and tipped them off that we are reading their codes and ciphers. And once, the German intelligence service, through an indiscretion of the State Department, succeeded in finding out that we were reading the messages, and then after some hesitation, so advised the Japanese. No, and the Japanese had such confidence in their machine that they assumed, as everybody has to assume, that most of their paper and pencil codes had been compromised, but refused even to believe that the machine code had been compromised.
Another question I wanted to ask you, how are messages picked up or intercepted? And I understand, of course, that wireless is easy, it is radio.
Yes.
We listen in. But telegraph, how do we get that? Do we put taps on telephone telegraph cables? Or does a communications agency like RCA, for example, turn over messages sent over it at the demand of a friendly government?
Well, not in this country, or at least it's not supposed to in this country, because in this country the privacy of the telegraphic communications is very strictly controlled and I believe also assured. As a matter of fact, for quite some time, the greatest difficulty within the cryptological establishment of the United States was not to crack the enemy's code, but to procure the messages, the intercepts. Of course, all this became quite easy when the wireless telegraphy was introduced. Before that, like the Rothschild, for example, they had to intercept the couriers of their competitors and the adversaries, and take away the letters they were carrying, steam open the seal, break the seal of the letters. You know that, for example, more than 70% of the communications of the United States at the in revolutionary time never reached the envoys in Europe, because the British succeeded more than 70%. If the communications were not only tedious, tenuous, and long, but also extremely precarious, because the British succeeded in intercepting most of the couriers. Now, most of the interception is done by monitoring the radio traffic. And this monitoring is done by mechanical devices which pick up everything that goes through the air.
Now, we've spent a good deal of time talking about a vastly interesting topic, but I do want to get on to something related a little more closely to Pearl Harbor. This occurred to me to ask you, were we negligent, maybe stupid, certainly overconfident, in allowing Pearl Harbor to come about? We could perhaps have done no more than had our fleet out of that harbor when the attack came, but that would have been a very great deal with a very considerable effect on the war.
That was very little.
Should we have done something that we didn't do? Or?
Dean Bauer, if I may say so, this is a very complex question.
I'm sure it is.
a complex question that can be answered black and white. One can say, according to your political attitude, if you like Roosevelt, you say that there was nothing he could have done. If you dislike Roosevelt, you say that could have been that he himself conspired to make the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. Actually, Roosevelt was not averse to getting the United States into the war because the British needed us, the Russians needed us, and he was absolutely determined to defeat the Nazis, for which I think we ought to be grateful to him. What I criticize in this attitude and in this activity was that he did not take the American people into his confidence, that he used all kinds of shenanigans and backdoor diplomacy in order to get into the war, not only backdoor diplomacy, but all kinds of provocative measures in the Atlantic. When the Germans didn't respond, he used this negotiation with the Japanese. But there was nothing he could have done to prevent the Japanese from going to war. Once he cornered them, once he pushed them into the corner with sanctions, with economic measures. Yes. And as far as the fleet was concerned, I think that once the showdown came, we were very fortunate that the fleet was caught in Pearl Harbor.
Oh, really?
Yes,
well,
we were vastly, because we were very fortunate that it wasn't at the open sea, because the fleet was in no position to take on the Japanese striking force. The Japanese striking force consisted not only of surface forces, surface units, but especially of a very great number of submarines, whose presence was completely unknown, and who could always have intervened and sink our ships by torpedoing them while we were engaged in challenging or answering the challenge of the surface units.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it had come to a surface engagement with these Japanese submarines providing the coup de grace, our fleet would have been sunk in deep water. We would not have had the opportunity of salvaging them, and we would have had to build an entirely new fleet mm-hmm. from scratch. As it was, the Japanese attacked the fleet in Pearl Harbor, the ships sank in shallow water, and within 3 to 6 months, they were back in service mm-hmm. again.
Well, that's a totally new and different point of view on this matter than I have ever heard before, and I'm very glad to have you present it. Are we better prepared these days, cryptographically, I mean? I know you can't go into details on this, but I do think that the American people, after this book and its revelations, want to have some answer to such a question as that.
Well, we have a better and bigger cryptological establishment today in the form of an agency which does openly what our cryptological establishments used to do quite secretly, tucked away in the Navy and the Army and the State Department. Today they have their own tremendous agency in the form of the National Security Agency, which is as big as the Central Intelligence Agency, if not bigger. It is engaged in developing our crypto system to prevent others from encroaching upon it. It's engaged in encroaching upon the crypto systems of others. And according to two defectors who went over to the Russians, because none of these systems are completely airtight, they are leaks, they are defections. Two defectors who had reason to know what they were talking about, they said that we are reading the messages, the encrypted messages of as many as 40 countries today.
Mm.
And since I don't think we have 40 enemies, there must be a few friends among them too.
Well, that's very reassuring. Well, thank you, Mr. Ladislav Varago, for this chance to talk with you about The Broken Seal, a book that is a stirring, exciting account of the train of events that led to Pearl Harbor and our participation actively in World War II. Its drama, its history, and it's what the American people ought to know about their national security in times past and with implications for the future. Broken Seal is published by Random House.
You've heard Warren Bauer and author Ladislas Varago as they discussed the book, The Broken Seal. This was another program in the series The Reader's Almanac. On our next program, Mr. Bauer's guest will be Gladys Brooks, author of If Strangers Meet. The Reader's Almanac is produced by Warren Bauer and is originally broadcast by station WNYC, New York. The programs are made available to this station by National Educational Radio. This is the National Educational Radio Network.